Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts. Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi. Here now, Tony Bruschi.
Here's the thing about Brian Koberger. He's not just another narcissist who ended up in prison. He's a man who spent years studying criminology, writing about abnormal psychology, and even trying to diagnose himself through the killers he researched. He's been desperate to understand what was wrong with him, and yet he's never been able to see the full picture. That's where the new details coming out are so telling. We've seen his letters from prison, his obsessive focus on food, his complaints about harassment, but we've also seen the longer arc, the obsessive searches online before his arrest, literally Googling paranoid psychopaths. The compulsive nightly drives that weren't about stargazing, but about peeping into windows. The porn searches fixated on unconscious victims and voyeurism. And then there's the way he clung to his parents, especially his mother, calling them daily, always referring to them as mother and father. Father, where is mother? She is not answering the telephone right now. It paints a picture not just of narcissism, but of dependence, fragility, and an ego that never learned how to stand on its own. So, in this segment of our interview with Siobhan Scott, I want to go deeper. What does all of this say about Koberger's brain, a brain that's broken in ways we're still piecing together? Why did control and domination become his only way to feel powerful? How did family dynamics, coddling, or over-involvement play into the man he became? And is there any possibility that therapy or self-awareness could have changed that trajectory? Or was this always going to end in darkness? That's where I want to take the conversation with Siobhan Scott, because if prison shows us who someone is under pressure, Koberger is already showing us a mind unraveling. But when you look at the bigger picture, the obsessions, the dependence, the fantasies, it tells us more about what drove him long before he was behind bars. So let's pick it up there. Siobhan, when you look at this lifelong struggle for control, the failures, the obsessions, the constant need for dominance, do you see this as a man searching for identity, or as someone who never had one to begin with?
Yeah, that, and it also strikes me that as much as I think he was studying the criminal mind and various aspects of abnormal psychology, he has been desperate to understand himself. Mm-hmm. And I think he probably saw facets of himself in the forensic studies and the other serial killers he was studying. But I still think at this point he doesn't have very good insight into what is really going on in his own mind. And so he keeps looking for things, looking for solutions, looking for an explanation. And He's just so messed up. He never finds it. He doesn't really get it.
Is there anything to find? I guess would be the question. I mean, in a way, if you take the murders out of the equation and you go back to Brian Koberger circa, 20-teen something, when he was writing those things about the visual snow online and feeling no empathy, feeling nothing towards his dad and how he was treating him, and just being really emotionless to anyone but himself. Mm-hmm. Is there a self to find? I mean, is there something deeper down that he is missing? And I mean, if there's, let me just ask that, is there something deeper to find? Is there anything that he's going to dig into there?
If I were working with him, God forbid, if I were, I would just work to help him understand that his brain is different from other people. And as much as he may want to identify as a psychopath, he also needs to understand autistic people and understand obsessive compulsive disorder, and then come to a place of seeing how this has colored his worldview and his relationships with other people. And that may be the best you could do with him, because yeah, he doesn't have that same ego core that the rest of us have that allows us to have deep attachments with people. And that's probably not something that he can manufacture. But could he come to a better understanding of the way his obsessive tendencies and his obsessive personality, the way that this impacts him? Mm-hmm. And obviously, we've heard a lot more coming out about his social problems.
Yeah.
And could he gain some awareness of how he comes off to other people? And I don't think he's had a clue about that.
Yeah, I don't think he has either. Even when it's spelled, if someone were to go and spell out in front of him, if we were to walk over to him with a video and go, look at this, look at the way you're interacting here and how this doesn't match up, would he be defensive? Would he go, well, I'm doing this because of this, and have an answer to those questions as to why he's acting the way he is? Or is there does he have an ability to be introspective on himself?
He has limited ability, and that's sure the thing that you would probably try to plug away with is trying to confront him and point these things out. Some of the I heard some forensic discussions this week from people who were going over his phone and his laptop and trying to trace the frequency of his calls to his parents. Yeah. And apparently he still calls them. He always called them mother and father.
Yes.
I mean, how weird is that? Who does that? And his way of being in the world, and yet he was calling them daily. And so this makes me think, was he completely dependent on them to try to be grounded in reality, to talk about his goals and plans? You know, whenever I've seen a college student who has to call a parent daily, it's because they're really fragile. Mm-hmm. And they need a lot of structure and a lot of help. And it's not a good sign. But the whole mother-father thing, it's like there, just everything about this guy, the more we learn, red flags that he was off. He was weird. It was really what I had guessed when they talked about they couldn't track all of his pornography use, but they could track a lot of searches. Mm-hmm. I think it was through the phone that he hadn't been able to completely cover it up. And what did we have? We had rape, we had unconscious victim, and we had voyeurism. And that does not surprise me at all. And I remember you and I were talking about when they were saying, oh, well, his main activity at night, he likes to go out driving. And I said, he's peeping. That's, you know, sex offenders who are out at night, they're looking in windows. Mm-hmm. And so it's like every part of this guy's life was off.
Yeah, I have always said where he initially made that statement, gazing at the stars, looking at the stars, stargazing. That's code for something else. Like he's saying it's stargazing, and to rest of us, we think looking at the stars. Mm-hmm. He means looking through college girls' windows.
Exactly.
is really what it is. Why is that? Like, look, if you're really that hard up for physical attention from the sex that you're attracted to, why is it that people will go and be interested in such dark, bizarre ways of looking at like the physicality of the human body, and we're looking at it in such weird ways of voyeurism, of passed out, of you know, negrophilia. I mean, just all these dark, like nothing, anything anyone should ever want to be involved in. But somehow this is clicking in his mind as, That's hot. I mean, is that a trauma response, or is that just somehow his brain is into doing the dead?
It's paraphilia, you know, these are categories of weird sexual, the things that excite people versus what most of us, you know, most of us can form bonds and have an emotional connection. Well, he doesn't do that. And so I think these particular ones with an unconscious woman or peeping someone that doesn't know he's there, it gives him a sense of power and control. And obviously that was very important to him in his sexual fantasies. So I don't think it's a trauma response. Again, I think it's you've got a broken brain with this guy, and he became probably very fixated on control. Mm-hmm. And he has a lot of anger, and these were sexual fantasies. Probably, you know, this porn history goes back for years, if not a couple decades.
It never clicks over to individuals like this, power, control. I mean, obviously, look, we all enjoy having control over our lives. We all enjoy having somewhat of a sense of power and agency of ourselves. That's there's nothing wrong with that until it goes way too far. Right. But in a mind like this, it never clicked over like, hey, you might have healthy power and control of your own life and some a say in your relationship by developing that with someone else, not ripping all of their control away and you're the only one in control. But that seems to be the only way this equation works for his brain.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. This is, and when we talk about what's missing inside of him, it's that ability to have a deeper attachment and to have more depth in his own personality. Instead of this bundle of random, weird, aggressive sexual impulses that fortunately most of us do not have.
Yeah. The search that he was making the night, the 29th, as police were closing in, the 30th is when they came in and did the raid. But he seemed to feel that things were closing in. He's searching about wiretaps. And the search that really got me is paranoid psychopaths, searching how paranoid psychopaths handle the anxiety of things closing in on them, defining himself as a paranoid psychopath in that search. I would say probably most paranoid psychopaths aren't necessarily doing that sort of a search in that literal of terms. But he's literally saying, that's who I am. Because is that part of him trying to identify still with all these other killers? And this is how, well, I'm a paranoid psychopath, so how should I handle this? Mm-hmm. It's a weird way of examining the present around you.
Mm-hmm. Very weird, very weird. And it would, it takes me back to why is he studying criminology and abnormal psychology, driven by an attempt to understand himself. Mm-hmm. And, he could latch on to certain things at certain times because he was studying it. Mm-hmm. And so he was able to recognize that his obsessive thoughts, again, were paranoia, but there was a reason for it. So was it really paranoia, or was it simply he was having a moment of flashing on reality that they were closing in?
Yeah. I'm curious, and this would just be pure speculation, and I do have a lot of respect and a lot of empathy and a lot of grace for his parents. Mm-hmm. I'm in no way wanting to say these are bad people. They had two other daughters that are successful, and they came out of the house, and, in their own little way there at home, I mean, they don't really have a history, as far as we know publicly, of anything bad or abuse or any of that. But the fact that mom's sitting there having these conversations with her son, it was an extreme amount of hours after he had been charged with these crimes in those prison, those jail cells before he admitted to this. What do you think was going on in those conversations with mom?
I can only speculate that she has served throughout the course of his life to try to keep him calm, because my guess is he's always had a tendency to get wound up, to get very anxious. And often it does sort of fall to mom to be the one. I mean, when my kids very seldom have called with upset situations as adults, but occasionally if they call, you know, if somebody's upset, one of my son's cats died suddenly and he was just so distraught and upset. He was very bonded with his cat. Who did he call? He called mom. And so I think moms serve that function very often. Dads may too, but it's most often mom, that when somebody is cracking, that they turn to mom. And that's just sort of what mom is used to doing. And I don't ever get the sense that the parents did anything wrong with him, that they were abusive in any way, but they probably also are very used to him, we'll just say his specialness, his unique qualities, and so get very comfortable, okay, I've got to calm him down again. That would be my guess.
They I agree. I doubt they, you know, did anything wrong with him in the traditional sense of like abuse, but and it may just come down to, we don't know what to do with him. And that probably is the ultimate answer of just not knowing what, because what do you do with
what
that?
What do you do?
But is there a level in there of not doing something, or they clearly did do some things. They turned him into the police when he stole the sister's phone. But, and this is a question I'm sure they're going to be racking their brains with for the rest of their lives. Could we have done anything different? And this is not to insult them or say, well, they should have thought of this, should have thought of that, because no one knows how to deal with someone who's capable of this. But if you were to look at it in hindsight and you were to say, there's another parent out there that is listening to this going, you know, I'm afraid my kid's going to turn into another Brian Koberger or something of the sort. They have all the way they act, the way that they see things, and there doesn't seem to be anything to pull them back. What do you say to those parents that are sitting there wondering and waiting for, you know, the phone call to come that, you know, little, you know, Brian 2.0, you know, went and killed some people or essayed some people? And you kind of knew all along, this person doesn't seem to have the rails to keep them from going in those directions.
It's terribly hard. And my heart goes out to his parents and every other parent who's got a kid that just came out not quite right. And if they have antisocial tendencies, it's scary. And so, of course, I always say I have a bias for therapy. If they can get them connected with a therapist, who knows how many terrible things are prevented because somebody was able to connect with a therapist. And I like to think that we do some good in the world. But again, once they're 18, parents don't have any control over that. And so I would then advise parents to go talk with a therapist about strategies, because every family's different. Every case is going to be different. And that doesn't mean that the parents have a mental illness or a mental health condition, but just for problem solving. And, you know, I talk with a lot of parents over the years who came in because they were worried about a kid. A kid was doing something that was a red flag. And then we would try to problem solve on how do you cope with this and what are some interventions.
And that's what I think a lot of it comes down to is, you know, once you have your 18-year-old kid, you don't have any control. They can do whatever they want. But they kept that type on. It's not like Koberger went away and was like, I'm going to go do my random things. I mean, he obviously did, but he still kept a very tight bond with them. Is there an element here to this story where maybe there was too much control? Maybe there was too much communicating unhealthily between mom and son or father and son or whatever it may be. And again, not saying that they're like, hey, go kill people or anything like that, but too much coddling, too much solving Brian's problems for him, leading up to all of this, where he had no problem solving skills, because he obviously demonstrated early in life he didn't have very many good problem solving skills. And rather than exercise that muscle earlier, was there a level of enabling here of, you know, we're coddling this kid to such an extent that he can't handle anything out of the ordinary or anything in life that's coming towards him, and that he just goes to power control, which is a very infantile way of thinking, rather than a more mature way of thinking of interpersonal connection and handling things in that line, but he goes to power control. Is this a reflection sometimes? I'm not saying it of them, but I'm saying it in general of over coddling of these kids to the point they're 30 something and still need to get mom and dad's approval, or they need to borrow this or they need to borrow that. It's like, can we just get our kids to grow the F up at some point in time and let them be adults and rather still stop coddling? And because sometimes in a healthy mind, it can work out okay. But when you don't have a healthy mind, I think you get more of this sort of folk.
Mm-hmm. It sure can develop into that. I'm thinking of another friend who tries to control every class her kid is taking in college. Mm-hmm. And she's already got picked out. I mean, she picked out his college, she picked out his major, and she's also got his career path planned. And so she monitors his homework assignments. And we're talking about a 20-year-old. And, you know, that's my message to her all the time is let him. So what if he screws up? Maybe he'll fail a class. That's a learning experience, right? You can't control everything. And she does it in a way of being loving and supportive and wanting him to have success. But it's really about her needs.
Yeah.
To have her child be a perfect reflection of her. So then we go back to the Adelsons and the narcissism thing there of the over-involved parent. But yes, I think that's the goal in parenting is we don't want to raise a dependent adult. We want to raise an independent person. Yeah. And that should be throughout childhood, encouraging more independence and autonomy. And of course, you have to do that in an age-appropriate way because when they're little, they need a lot more help and support. Mm-hmm. But that's the goal, is to let them be independent.
Yeah. I mean, and when you get that, like we were giving that example there, is she doing that because she wants that child to succeed and lead a happy and healthy life? Or is she doing that because she wants to go and tell her friends, oh, look, they're doing this. This is the vision I had for them. And, oh, I'm so proud of them. But at the end of the day, they're proud of themselves because they jammed their kid into this slot.
Very true.
And they're fitting the mold, at least until they crack. Yeah. And they're like, I don't want to do any of this.
Yeah,
I mean,
very true.
Yeah. I mean, that seems to be a lot of it goes back to the ego, not necessarily of the kid, but of the parent in some
very
situations
true.
Like that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And a lot of things that are framed as love mm-hmm. are really about concern for self and concern for mm-hmm. own ego rather than what is really best for my son here. Yeah.
It seems to come back to a fear of letting the kids fail. And, mm-hmm. and I think most successful people will say, failing are the best things in life because it teaches you how to do better. It teaches you what doesn't work, what does work, and it strengthens you. But I feel like we get so many folks out there today that have no experience in failure and the smallest of hiccups mm-hmm. in the world, like not getting the fruits on the tray at lunch and he wants the extras. It turns into a major, major issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much so. And we don't do our kids a service when we create dependency and when they're dependent on us for basic mood regulation. But everybody's different. And I think Brian came out of the chute with some abnormal ways of seeing the world and ways of being in the world and a very different kind of brain. And it would be hell to have a kid like that and try and figure out how in the world do we try to help this person develop into a normal, independent adult.
What's striking in this conversation with Siobhan is how clearly Koberger's mind was broken long before he ever set foot in a prison cell. The obsessions, the paraphilias, the peeping, the compulsive need for power, none of that came out of nowhere. It was years in the making. And while prison is magnifying it now, the seeds, they were there from the beginning. We can argue about nature versus nurture, about whether his parents coddled him too much or not enough, or simply didn't know what to do with him. We can speculate about whether therapy could have altered his course, but the reality is this. Some people come into this world wired differently. And when those differences mix with ego, anger, and sexual deviance, you get the kind of volatility that eventually explodes. The most sobering piece here is that Koberger is not unique. He's part of the pattern we've seen in other killers. Men who lacked the ability to connect, who turned control into fetish, who studied others' darkness, in a failed attempt to make sense of their own. The prison system will grind him down just as it has others, but nothing changes the fact that his brain never clicked into the place where healthy attachments, empathy, and self-regulation live. So where does that leave us? With a clearer picture of why people like Koberger end up where they do. With a reminder that control and dominance are the only languages some broken minds speak. And with the knowledge that for all his letters, his complaints, his obsessions, there's no redemption arc coming. What you're seeing now, the unraveling, the paranoia, the dependence, it's the same man he's always been, just without the thin layer of normalcy he once used to hide behind it. And that, I think, is a lesson. The prison cell didn't break Ryan Koberger. Just exposed why and what was already broken. Tell me your thoughts in the comments section. What's going to come of Koberger? Is this going to just turn into some crazy breakdown where it's rambling letters that make little to no coherent sense? Or is he going to find some stability? Is he going to find himself and end up penning romance novels for the next 30 years, become a bestseller? I doubt that. Let me know your thoughts, like I said, in the comments section on YouTube. If you're not already there, just search Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi to find us there, or wherever you get podcasts, same search, Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi, and you will find us. We do greatly appreciate you pressing subscribe. Do it right now so you don't forget. And again, your thoughts in the comments on YouTube. Would love to hear them. Until next time, I'm Tony Bruschi. We'll talk again real soon.
Want more on this case and others? Then press subscribe now and don't miss a moment of true crime coverage from Tony Bruschi and the Hidden Killers podcast.
Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.
Mr. Monopoly here. Monopoly is back at McDonald's. Register in the McDonald's app so you're ready to
get your bag.
2 ways to peel for a chance to
get your bag.
Physical peels with select items and digital peels with others to
get your bag.
At McDonald's. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
No purchase necessary. See rules at playatmcd.com for full details and amoe.playatmcd.com to play without purchase. Ends November 23rd, but bonus play ends November 2nd. Monopoly is a registered trademark of Hasbro. Copyright McDonald's.
Hi there. My name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialistly. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialistly with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts. Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialistly. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialistly with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts. Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialistly with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialistly with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts. Hi there, my name is Annie Elise, aka your true crime BFF and host of the podcast Serialously. I have been a true crime enthusiast forever, but I wished somebody would break down the cases for me like a friend, giving all the details and discussing every twist and turn. So I decided to create a podcast that does just that. Serialously with Annie Elise is topping the charts with over 1 million weekly downloads. I do the deep dives in these cases so you don't have to, diving into all the raw details, saying what we're all thinking, and in a conversational way, just like having a conversation with your best friend. So join me and let's talk all things true crime. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts. Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialously with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts. Are you someone who watches every true crime documentary the day that it releases and then find yourself always wanting to know more, Googling the timelines, red flags, and then falling into the social media rabbit hole? Well, I'm here to do all of that for you, bringing the facts, theories, and details that no one else is covering on my hit true crime podcast, Serialously with Annie Elise. Whether it's everything with the Idaho 4 case now that the documents are unsealed, or shocking cases you've never heard of, packed with love triangles, cults, and twists you won't see coming. With over 1 million downloads a week, I break it down for you just like your best friend would. Serialously with Annie Elise. New episodes drop every Monday and Thursday wherever you get your podcasts.